minor prophet with a major message. Now my pleasing duty to call on Brother David Palfreyman to deal with Obadiah.
Good evening, my dear brothers and sisters. Obadiah, minor in length, certainly. Next to the second and third letters of John, this is one of the shortest books in the whole of the Bible. But even so, its message is a significant one. But there is only one theme of prophecy in the book, and it covers more or less the section that we've had read from Jeremiah chapter 49, and it's only two-fifths of that chapter. So you can see how brief and concise the book is. And because of this, we don't find in the book of Obadiah the sort of information and help that we'd find in some of the longer books. So we're told nothing about Obadiah. He only just gets his name in, doesn't he, right in the first sentence of the first verse. And in this short prophecy, we don't have, as we do in the longer ones, any historical sections which help us to identify quite clearly when Obadiah prophesied. And so as we go through, we'll hope to be able to pick up a few items of evidence as to not particularly who Obadiah was, but when he was prophesying. The name Obadiah means one who worships Yahweh, and so it may in fact be no more than a title of a prophet, just as Theophilus may well just have been the title, almost the nickname of the person to whom Luke was writing, or as we heard last week, that the name Ahasuerus may not have actually been his name, but his title. And so Obadiah himself is somewhat rather shrouded in mystery. There are 11 Obadiahs mentioned in Scripture, but we can't really identify any one of them as being for sure the writer of this prophecy. And so then there is one message which fills this one short book, and it concerns the judgment on Edom for her vengeance on Judah, and that in particular on further examination might give some clue as to when Obadiah prophesied. Obadiah clearly announces the theme of judgment to come on Edom. And so the prophet writes, "The vision of Obadiah, thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom, we have heard a rumour from the Lord, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us up against her in battle." This verse is unusual in that it suggests that the Lord should be engaged in starting rumours. And in the sense that we understand the word rumour, that surely would not be the case. But in fact, this verse is speaking as if it's a report from a third person, of someone who has heard the prophecy. And that word rumour really means message or tidings. And so the verse is, we have heard a message or tidings, or of course the prophecy itself from the Lord. An ambassador is sent among the heathen. In this instance, this would be Obadiah himself. And so, arise ye and let us rise up against her in battle. And then we have the identity and the situation of Edom in verse 3. And there we read of Edom, thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high. And the phrase, dwelling in the clefts of the rock, also comes in that parallel passage to the book of Jeremiah that we read from, in Jeremiah that we read in chapter 49, which is a parallel to Edom. So if we turn back to Jeremiah chapter 49, in verse 14, we have there the repetition about the rumour coming from the Lord, the message, the prophecy. And then verse 16, thy terribleness hath deceived thee, and the pride of thine heart, O thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, that holdest the height of the hill, that thou shouldest make thy nest as high as the eagle, I will bring thee down from thence, saith the Lord. And Eden has many names. One of them, to describe the nation, is Mount Seir. And again, we have the emphasis on the high fastness of the capital of the land, which gave the people their false confidence. Rather like the city of Jerusalem when David laid siege to it. The Jebusites proudly boasted that the city was so naturally well defended that it only needed the blind and the lame to look after it. But we know that nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, the same as the city of David, and it changed hands. And so Edom, mankind, puts his trust in mountains and cliffs and castles. But like David himself, the man of God puts his trust in God. So then, a little bit of geography about Edom. This was the land, the area that was settled by Esau, and it is, roughly speaking, the east and the south of the Dead Sea, between what is now Jordan and further to the south, Saudi Arabia. And to this day, it's a land of desolate and steep mountains. And the capital city of Edom was called Selah. And the inhabitants were indeed troglodytes. Troglodytes are people who dwell in caves. And the site of Selah was rediscovered in 1812, and it's very popular with visitors today, but it is now known by its Greek name of Petra. And of course, you would recognize that in the Greek means a rock or a stone, just as Jesus made a pun on the name of Peter. Selah in the Hebrew, Petra in the Greek, the rock. That rose-red city, half as old as time, as the poet describes it. And so visitors who go there today into that rocky canyon can see a remarkable set of buildings in the classical style, with columns and pediments and everything else, literally cut out of the rock of the cliff face. But those don't really date back to the days of Edom, because they were cut out in the Roman times. But so there we are, Edom, by its attitude and by its very geography, placed their confidence in their rocky stronghold. Not so King David, who says in Psalm 18, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my strength, in whom I will trust." A contrast there between self-sufficient, self-reliant Edom, which is to come to its end, and the man who trusts in God. And so back to Obadiah. The theme of the high eminence is continued in verse 4. "Though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord." There's nothing that man can do to defend himself against the judgment of God. In this case, the reference to an eagle is significant, as we shall see later. The eagle is a bird of prey. It does nest on cliffs to protect itself. And this is the reason for the choice of an eagle in Matthew 24. Jesus says, "Wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered." A great, a high-flying bird of prey, rather like the vulture, and sometimes in Scripture the translation would be better vulture than eagle. It's a symbol of destruction and judgment. And in verse 5 we come to another section, which again is quoted by Jeremiah. So this suggests that Jeremiah and Obadiah were almost contemporary, and that Jeremiah was aware of the prophecy of Obadiah. And Jeremiah, quoting from him in that 49th chapter, he says, "If great gatherers come to thee, would they not leave them gleaning grapes?" They certainly would under the law of Moses. They were required to do that. So there's the poor and the stranger could find something to eat. If thieves by night, he says, they will destroy until they have enough. Even the thieves will only take what they want and go. But the destruction, the judgment on Edom will be complete. And so the emphasis is on the totality of the destruction to be visited on Edom. They are to be utterly cut off. And then down to verse 7, that indicates that even their own allies have deceived Edom and contributed to their downfall. If we turn to Psalm 83, we see there who the allies are. We have in Psalm 83 the confederacy of which Edom is a member. And we also here learn what the purpose of this confederacy is. Psalm 83 and verse 4. The confederates have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. And that now indicates the reason for Obadiah's prophecy against Edom. The reason that God is to judge Edom so severely. Because Obadiah himself has not yet given the reason. And then in verse 6 and verse 7, we have the list of the confederates. The tabernacles of Edom and the Ishmaelites, of Moab and the Hagarines, Gebel and Ammon and Amalek, the Philistines with the inhabitants of Tyre. And you notice that Edom is listed first there, as if they were the leaders, they were the prime group. And those nations listed in verse 6, they're more than just political or geographical confederates, aren't they? First of all, Edom, or the descendants of Esau, well, they are the descendants of Jacob's twin brother. Amalek, he was a grandson of Esau. The Ishmaelites, well, they were the sons of Jacob's uncle. Moab was Lot's son. And Ammon was Lot's grandson. The Hagarines, of course, came of Hagar, Sarah's handmaid, who bore Ishmael. Gebel is a town in the north part of Edom, otherwise known as Teman. And the only non-relatives of Jacob there, if you like, are the Philistines and the inhabitants of Tyre. The Philistines came, they were immigrants from the Greek island of Crete. So, make no mistake about it, those confederates there in the essence of the Jewish-Arab conflict are all members of the same family. It's a family argument, and it still is. So then, back to Obadiah to continue the prophecy. We'd reached verse 7, and there we read that the surrounding related nations, the confederacy, they had made Edom the fall guy, the stool pigeon. They had set them up. And the result is to be that the destruction visited upon the wise men of Edom in verse 8 and their mighty men in verse 9. And then from verse 10, Obadiah now gives the reason for God's wrath and judgment upon Edom. Verse 10, for thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. In the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them. But thou shouldest not have looked on the day of thy brother, in the day that he became a stranger. Neither shouldest thou have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction. Neither shouldest thou have spoken proudly in the day of their distress. Thou shouldest not have entered into the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Yea, thou shouldest not have looked on their affliction in the day of their calamity, nor have laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. Neither shouldest thou have stood in the crossway to cut off those of his that did escape. Neither shouldest thou have delivered up those of his that did remain in the day of his distress. That's what Edom had done to Judah, and for that they were to be utterly cut off. And I think this is perhaps the point at which to remind ourselves of the history of Edom and their relationship with Judah. And of course it goes right back to the birth of those two tribal fathers. So let's turn back to Genesis chapter 25. Keeping your finger in Obadiah, we'll be coming back again. Genesis chapter 25, and in verses 24 to 26 we read there that they were twins, but that quite definitely Esau was the elder, but that they were quite different kinds of people. And so verse 27, and the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter and man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. The description of Esau as a cunning hunter indicates a wily, adventurous, outdoor sort of man. But by contrast, Jacob was a plain man. He was an upright, honest sort of man, that kind of plain man, straightforward. And he was content to live in a tent, not really the outdoor sort at all. And then in verse 31 we have the incident of the despised birthright. Esau was hungry, yes, he had need, he supposed. But remember, it was Jacob who suggested the sale of the birthright for a pot of vegetarian stew. He put the idea into Esau's mind. So Jacob wasn't too plain or upright or straightforward a man not to see the opportunity when it stared him in the face. And he took it by taking advantage of Esau. And then, going on to chapter 27, we have the, if you like, the felony of the stolen birthright compounded by the stolen blessing. And the outcome of these two events, which must have very much affected the relationship between Jacob and Esau as they grew up together. The outcome of these two events we find in Genesis 27 and verse 41. After Isaac confirms that there's nothing that he can do to reverse the blessing which he, by deceit, gave to Jacob, and which in that blessing it included that Esau would be Jacob's servant, and he couldn't change it. So verse 41, and Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing wherewith his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning for my father are at hand, then will I slay my brother Jacob. But it took a long time, didn't it? In Psalm 83, the policy was still being pursued. But as a result of that, Rebekah urged Jacob to flee from Esau's revenge, and that was the start of, well, nearly 4,000 years of hostility between Israel and Edom, and it still goes on, brothers and sisters, doesn't it? The first instance of that hostility comes in Numbers chapter 20. In verse 14, Moses calls on the king of Edom as a brother, a twin brother, of course. They ask for passage through their country as they approach the promised land. And not only did the Edomites refuse them permission to walk through the land, but it was very roughly refused, because we're told that Edom came out against Israel with much people and a strong hand. And that word strong there has with it the sense of being rather bad or obstinate. So it wasn't a very pleasant confrontation for Israel. There they were with their families, their wives and their children, and Edom came out in a very hard and harsh way. And of course, going back, when Esau was in need of help and sustenance, we've seen that Jacob took advantage of him. He extorted his birthright from him. And here, perhaps, in that incident, Edom, in a way, took their revenge when Israel were in need. Perhaps even they knew where Israel was going, and they were incensed by the thought that here were the children of Jacob coming to take possession of the land which they considered should have been theirs by their birthright, which they had lost. It was a pleasant and fertile land, in complete contrast to their own barren and mountainous abode in the land of Edom. So then back to Obadiah and verse 10. So Edom is condemned for their violence against Jacob. And it isn't just for one particular event here. We don't have any one in mind, but just one brief reference will show us the way things go. Turn back to 2 Chronicles and chapter 28. Second Chronicles 28 takes us back to the days of King Ahaz, who was one of an increasing number of Judah's evil kings, who were more and more like the kings of Israel had been to the north. And for his evil ways, God sent another punishment on him. Verse 16. At that time did King Ahaz send unto the kings of Assyria to help him. For again the Edomites had come and smitten Judah and carried away captive. The Philistines also had invaded the cities of the low country and the south of Judah, and had taken Beth-Shemesh and Ajalon and Gederoth and Shochoh with the villages thereof, and so on. But you notice, first of all, for again the Edomites had come and smitten Judah. So it wasn't an isolated incident. There was the continuing war between Esau and Jacob. And Ezekiel confirms the undying hatred of Esau for Jacob. Ezekiel chapter 35. And here we have Edom described as Mount Seir. And in this case, their punishment will come upon the mountains, the very mountains which they saw as their defense and their security, the place of their cliff dwellings that were their pride and joy. But no longer, when God brings his judgments to bear, these things are of no avail. Verse 5. Because thou hast had a perpetual hatred, and hast shed the blood of the children of Israel by the force of the sword in the time of their calamity, in the time that their iniquity had an end, because the word calamity came up several times in Obadiah. Therefore, as I live, saith the Lord God, I will prepare thee unto blood, and blood shall pursue thee. If thou hast not hated blood, even blood shall pursue thee. Thus will I make Mount Seir most desolate, and cut off from it him that passeth out and him that returneth. And I will fill his mountains with his slain men. In thy hills and in thy valleys and in all thy rivers shall they fall that are slain with the sword. And this judgment, as the prophet Amos says, wasn't for three transgressions of Edom, or for four, but because they had a perpetual hatred. And the only way to bring this perpetual hatred to an end, to bring this aggression to an end, was for God to make Edom desolate. And so, verse 9, I will make thee perpetual desolation, and thy city shall not return, and ye shall know that I am the Lord. Because thou hast said, these two nations and these two countries shall be mine, Israel and Judah, and we will possess it, whereas the Lord was there. And to this day the hills of Edom are desolate and bare. And so to Obadiah again, verse 11. In the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them. But thou shouldest not have looked on the day of thy brother, in the day that he became a stranger. Neither shouldest thou have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction. Neither shouldest thou have spoken proudly in the day of distress. And from verse 11 there, we can identify a historical event. Jerusalem is under attack. Foreigners enter into his gate, and because, of course, the gate of a city was not only its defense against attack, but was also the seat of its government, anyone who entered in and possessed a city gate possessed the city and had control of it. Remember that God promised to Abraham on Mount Moriah that his seed, which is Christ, should possess the gate of his enemies. And that, of course, is part of the promise that he will rule the world. Now, the event recorded here was an invasion of Jerusalem, quite clearly, when the inhabitants were taken captive. And in particular, it says, Judas' forces. This word doesn't just mean forces in a military sense, but it also refers to those who were men of ability and integrity and wisdom. People such as Daniel, of course, who was taken away in the first wave of captivity from Jerusalem. And since it particularly speaks of Jacob in the next verse, it is most probably the invasion and captivity of Judah by Nebuchadnezzar, which we find in detail in 2 Kings chapter 24. Because by this time the northern kingdom had gone into captivity, and therefore Obadiah speaks of Judah and doesn't include Israel. In 2 Kings chapter 24, at the beginning of the chapter, Nebuchadnezzar had already made Judah a subject nation in the days of Jehoiakim. So already the gates of Jerusalem were taken and possessed by their enemies because Nebuchadnezzar ruled over them and set up his own puppet as king. And then, in verse 11, we have the start of the first deportation. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came against the city, and his servants did besiege it. And Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother and his servants and his princes and his officers, and the king of Babylon took him in the 8th year of his reign. And verse 14, and he carried away all Jerusalem and all the princes and all the mighty men of valor, even 10,000 captives, all the craftsmen and the smiths. None remained save the poorest sort of the people of the land. So all the ruling classes, all the capable men were taken out of the land. These are the forces that Obadiah speaks of. Not only men of power and influence, but the men capable of doing anything, of organizing anything. So that none remained but the poorest sort of the people of the land. Not only poor in terms of money, but poor in terms of influence and initiative and ability. Particularly, of course, in terms of ability to organize any resistance or rebellion to Nebuchadnezzar. And Psalm 137 confirms this for us. The psalm doesn't have a title or a superscription, but there's no doubt of the subject of the psalm. There's no doubt about the time period for which it speaks. Psalm 137, verse 1. By the rivers of Babylon there we sat down, yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our hearts upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? The setting is very clear. This psalm records the circumstances and the feelings of the Jews who were taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar. But in verse 7 we have a detail that we haven't seen recorded by anyone else. But Obadiah hints at it. In the day that the strangers carried away captives his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, Obadiah says of Edom, even thou wast one of them. And we have confirmation of that in this psalm, in verse 7. Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom, in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, even to the foundation thereof. O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed, happy shall he be that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. Happy shall he be that taketh and dasheth either ones against the stones. For there were the Edomites at the desolation of Jerusalem, cheering Nebuchadnezzar to the echo, as it were, as he entered Jerusalem and despoiled the temple and took the best of the people captive. And again we go back to Obadiah, and in those verses from verse 12 to verse 14 we have a whole series, thou shouldest not have. The emphasis here is not only that Edom attacked Judah, but they've been doing that for the whole history of those two nations. They'd had a perpetual hatred, as Ezekiel said. But they were particularly condemned because they were doing it, in verse 12, to their brethren, and in verse 13, to God's people. And they were doing it in the very days of their destruction and calamity. And the key word of that passage is calamity. And then in verse 14, even where some thought that they had found a way of escape, Edom stood in their way and returned them to their tormentors. In the siege of Jerusalem, if any then thought to escape Nebuchadnezzar, perhaps to flee across Jordan and to hide in the hills in the mountain country of Edom and Moab, which of course some of the Jews did successfully during that last final siege of Jerusalem in AD 70. But if they did it here, they were hunted down by their own kith and kin, the Edomites, their brethren, their cousins, and they were handed back to their enemies. A vile and despicable act. But it will not always be so, because in all God's prophecies of judgment and destruction in Scripture, we find that there is always cause for hope for those who obey God. And so, from verse 17 to verse 21, there is hope for Jacob at last in his hour of need. And this time, Edom will not stand in the crossway to attack, but in this case, Edom will provide shelter. Verse 17, Jacob shall possess the possession of Edom. Verse 18, Jacob shall be a fire to Esau's stubble, as judgment there in the last days. But again, for some of the detail that Obadiah refers to here, we need to turn to other prophecies, this time to Daniel and chapter 11. Here in Daniel chapter 11 we have the invasion of the king of the north, who like a flood, like a tide, flows down through the promised land right down into Egypt, verse 40, overflows and passes over. Verse 14, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries, and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. And so there's an indication there that the land, the area which is defended by the presence and influence of the merchants of Tarshish and Sheba and Dedan, will also extend that influence to deflect the king of the north away from Edom and Moab and Ammon. And these areas, again, these are within the western borders of the present day kingdom of Jordan. And so the Gogian invasion will be contained to the west of the river of Jordan, but will pass right down through and into Egypt. From Isaiah chapter 16, it would seem that their escape is not so much for their own benefit as for the benefit of the fleeing Jews. And so for once, at least, in the very end of Gentile time, Edom and Moab and Ammon will provide shelter for some of their brethren. the very shelter which they've denied them with a perpetual hatred all these centuries. And it has been said recently that Israel may well take some surrounding Arab land before the northern invasion. This might be one means of giving them an opportunity of peace and safety, because they've pushed their borders out. The very opposite of what this Arab-Israeli peace conference is thinking it might achieve in exchanging land for peace. It's Jewish land for peace. But it might be, in fact, the other way around. We don't know. But this may happen, if for no other reason than to provide some much-needed land on which Israel can settle the growing stream of Jews who are now being released from Russia, for instance. The most likely countries for this to happen would be those which are the weakest politically, and this would include places like the southern part of Lebanon, which already they control. They have a great deal of influence in southern Lebanon still, and perhaps the western strip of Jordan. We've already identified the western strip of Jordan as being Edom and Moab and Ammon, and this would seem to be supported by verse 20 of Isaiah chapter 16. We'll just briefly turn to that chapter. No, sorry, it's up. We should be in Obadiah, shouldn't we? Verse 20 of Obadiah. And the captivity of this host of the children of Israel shall possess that of the Canaanites, even unto Zarephath. And the captivity of Jerusalem, which is in Sepharad, shall possess the cities of the south. And Zarephath is Lebanon's Sidon, so there you are in the southern part of Lebanon. And historically, over the years, that the land of Eden crept a little westward around the bottom of the Dead Sea towards the cities of the south, and so it may well be justified by that verse. But be that as it may, we've got to be very careful, haven't we, to not to speculate too much to the extent of trying to fit prophecy into current affairs and the way things are likely to go. It should be the other way around. We should be viewing current affairs in the light of what prophecy says. But what we do know is that it is prophesied of Edom, not only by Obadiah, that Edom will be judged and made desolate. The land is already a desolate place. But if Edom, or the daughter of Babylon, as she was styled in Psalm 137, is not to be judged by the northern invasion because they were spared, how will Edom be judged? And we thus have one final quotation from Isaiah and chapter 34. We won't turn to chapter 34, time's going by, but that tells us well-known words that the Lord hath a sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in the land of Idumea. But turn on quickly to chapter 63, which gives us a graphic description as Christ returns to judge for himself, doesn't he? Isaiah 63 and verse 1. Who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah? This that is glorious in his apparel, travelling in the greatness of his strength. I that speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Wherefore art thou ready in thine apparel, and thy garments like him that treadeth in the winepress? I have trodden in the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me. For I will tread them in mine anger, and trample them in my fury. And their blood shall be sprinkled upon my garments, and I will stain all my raiment. So the wheel has come full circle. Esau is at the last judged for his perpetual hatred of Jacob at the final judgment. And the land is to be a refuge and a possession for Israel in the kingdom. So having lived by the sword, as his father Isaac said that he would, having taken advantage when he had the dominion over Israel, his judgment will come in the last days, just as Obadiah prophesied when he wrote at the time of the 70 years captivity.